Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna on News Talk.
Yes, you can email the show, aliveandkicking@newstalk.com, or you'll find me on Twitter and Instagram. I'm at Claire McKenna Presents. Coming up this morning, Professor Anne-Marie O'Dwyer on why she poured her 40 years professional experience into her book, The Cancer Guide. Dr. Fiona Barry on the women who arrive at her core clinic exhausted but unable to rest, and how adult learning organisation AINTIS are transforming lives. It's never too late to embrace change in your life. So what kind of a health and wellness week did I have? Well, I was under the weather a bit this week. After a whirlwind week last week where I was firing on all cylinders and loving life, I settled down for a restful weekend. I was restful as it can be with kids, and I picked up a bit of a virus. Nothing major, but enough to slow me down, which I find very irritating. More on this later, but I've just done what I've had to do this week. I've skipped a couple of gym sessions to allow my body to rest and recover, which I hate, but I went with it. And I spoke on my Instagram stories this week about my struggle to rest and slow down. I mean, I had a facial booked, right? And I had it booked last month, and I was like, yes, I'm going to invest once a month that I'm going to do something nice for myself, and this is going to be this month. I cancelled it last month, moved it to this month, saw it was coming up, and again started, no, I can't. I don't have time. This is ridiculous. Went to cancel it, but I was inside the 48-hour window, so had to go. And I think it's really interesting that we talk about taking time for ourselves as frivolous. And okay, this facial had a cost associated with it. It sometimes can be free, the going for a walk, the meeting the friend for a coffee. There is a cost implement in this that I element to this that I get, but it wasn't really about that. And you might remember a while back I wore the heart variability monitor for the well-being advantage over a few days to look at my body on the go and at rest and how I managed to go from one area to the next. And you have to fill in a diary of sorts to match up with the data and what you were doing at the time, from working to driving to chilling out. And green was the time of rest. And there was one day when I went to get my nails done and there was a big spike of green when I was there. Now, I often get my nails done. I just think having your nails neat, there's all this new stuff now that means once you get them done, they pretty much stay that way for 3 weeks. And I do see it as sort of frivolous. And I swore during COVID that I'd never go back to having it done every 3 to 4 weeks. And here I am getting it done every 3 to 4 weeks with the same story rattling around in my head that it's frivolous. Now, again, let's take the cost into account. I wouldn't like to see what I spend a year or indeed over a lifetime on my nails. But it is something important. And Janine from the Wellbeing Advantage, when we were having our meeting and looking back on the data, she was like, you were really relaxed for that 45 minutes. What were you doing? Because that was a really positive thing for you to do. And later on that day, I had sat down to watch Netflix. I don't know why the kids weren't looking for me, or maybe I had dinner in the oven and I sat down and I put on, I remember, the most ridiculous reality show that I wasn't even really enjoying, but I just let it wash over me and I dozed off a little bit. And again, I would have looked at that as absolute trash time. What was I doing spending my time doing that? What a waste of time it was. But again, it was a big flash of green and a really important time in my day for my body to go in to rest and digest and for my central nervous system to relax. So I think we really need to have a mindset shift around rest, because there was also a spike of green when I would have done my meditation that morning or when I was reading before bed, and that this one is better than another one. I think rest is what's important. And I really had to catch myself this week because I was resisting it all the way. You can email the show aliveandkicking@newstalk.com. So with that said, I am hosting an event called The Rest Revolution in Cork next Sunday, the 28th of April, with Dr. Fiona Barry. And she joins me on the line now. Fiona, you're very welcome.
Thank you very much, Claire McKenna. How are you?
I'm good, thank you very much. I'm looking forward to this day next week. And you and I made a pledge that we'd do an event together after I helped open your Bishopstown clinic last year. And when we kind of had a couple of Zooms and a couple of calls and were trying to come up with what the topic was, you just kept saying that there were people coming to you at clinic who were overwhelmed, burnt out. But there's so many of us don't, as I've just said, give ourselves the permission to rest. Tell me about some of the stories you would have been hearing.
It's funny, I think we've got to a place in our lives where we see rest nearly as synonymous with laziness. I think we've forgotten that we're human beings, not human doings. And, you know, you even just, even if you go onto social media, you see that what's lauded really is productivity. It's nearly like, oh, I went to the gym at 6 this morning before I, you know, got the kids up and got their breakfast and got them ready for school and dropped them to school. And then I went to work. And this is precisely what I'm seeing in clinic. As well, I'm seeing a lot of women, obviously it's primarily women's health that I deal with, and I am seeing women who are coming in and they're really on their knees. I suppose we've never been busier. We're living in a sandwich generation. We're having kids later. So a lot of women, it is men too. I can't, you know, it isn't just women. But I guess, I suppose because we a lot of the time are the primary carers and we are the nurturers, it's just a biological fact. That we have women here who are just, they are trying to juggle everything. So they are juggling, you know, home commitments. So that be it a partner, children, possibly aging parents, and also a career. So they are constantly on the go. And the problem with that is when we are constantly on the go and we become chronically stressed, our body finds it really hard to relax. So a lot of these women, I'm finding they actually can't sit still. They're really struggling to sit still because even if they try to sit still and their body is looking for it, their mind is still in overdrive. That ticker tape is still running in the background, you know, thinking about, oh, you know, Julie's doing ballet and I have to organize her gear and Johnny's doing football and I have to, you know, wash his gear and who's going to drive them here and who's going to drive them there. It's like we honestly just never switch off.
And we seem to be the only species that do that. I mean, anyone who's watched a nature documentary, you'll see the lions around the savannah all lying there in the sun and, you know, they do what they have to do and then they rest. And the same with the dog. You take the dog for a walk and then most of the time we spend lazing around. We are the only species that when we feel tired, we just push through and keep going.
Absolutely. And this is what we're seeing. And the problem is it gets to a point then where people aren't even acknowledging how stressed out they are and the fact that they're constantly on the go. And what's happening is they're getting to a place where actually they're burnt out. And I'm seeing that more and more. And, you know, obviously 2020 and 2021 were very, very hard years for everybody. And we've picked ourselves back up and we have carried on. But I don't know if you remember during the first lockdowns, everybody was going, oh my God, this is amazing. You know, I'm literally smelling the roses, to coin a phrase. I'm getting time. I'm getting time with my kids. I'm getting time to be out in nature. Everybody was out walking and it was wonderful. And I think at the time we were all saying, oh, we need to remember this. We need to be doing more of this. And if anything, I actually think we've gotten worse. We've reverted because we started to get used to being a bit more isolated from each other. So I have clients coming into me now and they're constantly on the go. They're constantly busy. And that's what they talk about. And they talk about being in here with me. This is my 1 hour of rest. This is my 1 hour to myself during the week. And yet when I see them after a weekend, I'll say, what did you do for the weekend? And the answer is nothing. And I'm kind of going, okay, I was really busy, but I was doing nothing. And we've stopped, actually, that balance, that work-life balance has become even more imbalanced because a lot of people have stopped socializing. They've stopped going out. They've stopped meeting their friends. So, and instead, what has taken over then is obviously this kind of mindless go, go, go.
Yeah, that's so interesting. And then we're missing out on pockets of joy in our life and way to fill up our cup that little bit more. So, at the event, we're going to have a talk from your good self and you're going to be giving lots of advice around that area. We have a panel discussion with some special guests on the same topic and then some restorative yoga and a sound bath. For people who don't know what a sound bath is, can you fill them in?
Yeah, it is the most amazing experience. I've done a number of sound baths now. I still remember my first one. And this is where you have somebody, everybody's going to be lying down wrapped in a blanket. So you get to lie whatever way is comfortable for you. Somebody might decide that they'd like to sit. For me, I generally just flake out. And then we have the amazing Fiona McDonough. She's traveling from Galway to be with us. And she then starts. So you have everything from like a massive gong. I always think of the King and I when I see the big gong, and everything down to, you know, the Tibetan singing bowls. And so it's a series of sounds. And what it is we have to remember, sound is an energy, it's a vibration. So what it is you are getting different sounds that are at different vibrations and at different frequencies to help our brains to get into that lovely theta state, which is kind of, you know, that kind of dreamy meditative state, that kind of feeling that you have, you know, just when you're on the cusp of sleep, where everything is kind of, you feel like you're floating. And that's really what it is. So it is, it's working with that. And Fiona's very good at working with the energy of the people in the room. So I just can't wait myself, to be honest.
Yeah, I hope, I keep meaning to say to you, I hope we do get to wrap ourselves in a blanket and soak all that up as well. And I think for anyone who finds it hard to rest and relax and sit still, the minute your mind starts to wander, another instrument starts and you're kind of back in the present moment. So it's a win-win, and people should float out of there in rest and digest mode and inspired to eke out more ways of prioritising it in their lives. Because I think it's lovely to have an event and to spend a Sunday afternoon investing in yourself, but you have to take what you've learned and make sure that you're going to schedule it in, because nobody is going to give you that time unless you take it. So look, Fiona, I'm really looking forward to it. It's this day next week. It's taking place in the gorgeous grain store at Ballymaloe, which I also can't wait to check out for myself. And if you would like to join us, there are some tickets available on Eventbrite. Just search for Rest Revolution, and there's more info on my Instagram at Claire McKenna Presents. Dr. Fiona Barry, thank you so much for coming on, and I will see you next Sunday.
Thanks, Claire. Can't wait to see you.
Alive and kicking on News Talk.
Now, in her many years treating cancer patients, Professor Anne-Marie O'Dwyer often heard the phrase, "If only I'd known that beforehand." And with that, and the fact that information is power in mind, Professor O'Dwyer has written The Cancer Guide for those with a diagnosis and the people who care for them. And she joins me in studio now. Well, Anne-Marie, you're very welcome.
Thank you very much.
So that phrase came up time and time again, "If only I'd known beforehand." What type of situation would people be referring to?
It came up in so many ways, Claire, and it really drove me when I was writing this book. I could hear it. It would come up. I have one person in mind now who was one of my first people I looked after. And that person had had a very bad reaction to a drug, steroids, which are very helpful drugs, just to be clear for people who are listening. They're extremely helpful. They do a very good job. But she had a particular response that made her go very manic in her mood. And she was a very private, reserved person. And when she got better, she was so horrified about what had happened to her that she begged me to make sure that people would know. That's just one example, and that's a very specific example. There were also lots of other examples. I know you've read the book. For example, people would say that when they got to the end of treatment, it was the most difficult time for them. And being able to manage their expectations. So one of the things that happened was they had these expectations that it would be amazing. They'd finish their treatment. Everybody was delighted for them. It was a big day. Their friends might plan to take them out to dinner. Their family would be on standby. And of course, it is a big day. It's great to be done with trudging into the hospital for your chemotherapy or your surgery or whatever. But actually, they didn't feel brilliant on that day. They felt absolutely exhausted, wrecked, tired, demoralised and frightened, because often it was their first chance to sit down and say, gosh, what's happened to me? Look where I've been. I've looked death in the face, you know. And so it was a very difficult time for them. And then their family and friends would be saying, oh, you must be delighted. You know, are you thrilled? And they wouldn't be thrilled. And then they'd feel guilty for not being thrilled, for not being grateful. And their friends and family understandably would start to withdraw support. And then they'd feel even worse. So that's just another small example. If for people who are listening, family, friends and patients themselves, yes, the end of treatment, it's a wonderful day, but please know it's the start of your rehabilitation. And say to people, yes, I'll be finished, but I'll need at least 6 months, maybe longer, to get myself back to a situation where I can begin to manage physically and psychologically again. If it's shorter than that, brilliant, celebrate. But say 6 months and then you can take it from there.
And to expect that, as you say, to have knowledge of that.
It's so important.
But something you said about the patient with the reaction to steroids, mm-hmm. sometimes when it comes to the worst case scenario and hearing all of the possible side effects, and I feel like the medical world has begun to tell people that a little bit more, maybe because of the way the world has gone with a suing culture in many ways, as well as compassion and wanting to impart knowledge. How does that play on a person's ability to get through something? Do they need to know the good,
well,
the bad and the ugly?
That's an excellent and complex question, which I will do my best to answer. So I think that information is power. It has to, first of all, be the right information. You know, we've so much information now, and people Google, and then they come up with information that is either incorrect or very unhelpful. So I think information is power, but it has to be geared to the person in front of you. So some people want to know everything. Some people want to know very little. And I think we need to say to people, what do you know already? And what would you like to know? And to be guided by them. Because sometimes too much information can literally cause people to freeze. So it is a balance. But I do think, in general, some information is very important. I don't want to, we seem to have started on steroids today for whatever reason. I don't, but it's important that people know that if you're on, for example, steroids, which, as I say, are a great drug, that you can run into problems with your mood, with not sleeping well, and that can lead to other things. And if you intervene early, the problem is solved. You can stay on your steroids and it's fine. And not just steroids, but all treatments, of course, bring wonderful things. And again, it's important, as you've said earlier about information, to say that, of course, in 2024, the rates for cancer are excellent. It's being picked up early. People are responding well. People are living for a very long time. So it's important to stress that to people. But yet, of course, it still causes fear for patients and their families. And that's what this book is about. What is that fear about? Why is it that people still have that fear? Despite the fact that results for many people, not for everybody, but for many people, that results are so good. And it is trying to get that balance right. And that culture, when I was training as a medical doctor, which is a very long time ago, I remember well, I worked with wonderful people. But back then, literally, we would do a ward round and I was the most junior person on the team carrying all the x-rays. You won't even remember times like that, staggering under a weight of x-rays as we walked around the wards. And the consultant would say to somebody, you've a bit of a shadow there, we're going to take it out. That was it. That was the discussion. And clearly that meant the person had no information at all about what was going on. And the consultants felt that was, or the doctors or the healthcare professionals in general felt that was a good way to manage. It was very paternalistic. We've now swung to the other direction where, as you say, we give people every single piece of information. And I'm not certain that every single piece of information is always helpful. I have come across patients on wards with a pile of 10 or 12 articles from some, you know, The Lancet or some very important journal of medicine about the benefits and disadvantages of adjuvant chemotherapy. I mean, they are not in a position to make that judgment, in my opinion, unless they have, you know, multiple medical qualifications. In general, people with cancer are very vulnerable. They're very afraid. They're in an area that they don't know anything about, and they need to feel that they have an expert looking after them who will help them.
And I know from friends and family who've come out of a diagnosis, you're sort of reeling. Once you get the diagnosis, you're not really listening or taking in information anymore, which is why they often say bring somebody with you and maybe a pen and paper. But something like your book then to turn to can be, you know, really useful, because there's a time and a place for taking in information and processing what's going on. And you also say in the book that you want to help people nurture their well-being from diagnosis through cancer and beyond. And nurturing well-being is not something we often hear around cancer. We just think of it as being a very sick time. And I don't mean to desensitize the tough road many people go on, but there is an option for nurturing well-being throughout that.
And I think that's a very important concept to discuss. Absolutely. You'll see I talk there about the tunnel of tests. You know, there are things that people have to go through. They're so difficult for people, getting through the tunnel of tests, getting through their treatment. It's very difficult. But then there is that time of rehabilitation, which we've just talked about, where there is the option for people to look at where they want to go next. Exactly as you say, when people get the diagnosis, they say it's like being hit by a bus. I can't speak, I can't hear, everything stops. And they say things like, you know, my life has gone up into the air and I'm waiting to see where the pieces will fall. But many people say to me, I'm not putting the pieces back where they were before. I want to do things differently. Now, that's not on the end of the day of their last day of treatment when they're too tired to even tie their shoelaces. That's when they've gone through their rehabilitation. They often say, I don't want to commute for 5 hours a day, or I don't want to work for 6,000 hours a week, or there's people that I meet that, you know what, I don't feel too good after I meet them. I don't want to meet them anymore. So people do use the time and the opportunity to look at how they want to spend their lives from now. Because most of us really live in denial, if you like. We don't think about the fact that, you know, death is coming our way. I don't even like saying it to you. You're looking like you prefer if I didn't mention it either. But it is. But for somebody who's had cancer, their boss has hit, you know, and they really want to think about how precious their time is, how they want to spend it. And often that means looking in different places. And I talk about, you know, looking at your physical activity, looking at your mental health, looking at your leisure time, looking at your family time. How do you spend your time? I mean, if people want to go back, well, go forward to the way that they managed their life before, that's absolutely their choice and you support them in doing that. But many people say, I'm not sure I do.
Yeah, and that can be daunting in many ways to think about how are you going to put this jigsaw back together differently, but empowering in others if people are given the right information and expect this maybe once they process after the treatment and they feel ready, which I think is really important. You're keen to dispel some myths around cancer. Can you talk to us about some of those?
I'm very keen. I'm so glad to have the opportunity. I mean, one of the things that would make my heart sink in my office was when somebody would come in and say to me, apparently with cancer, you're supposed to. And I used to take a deep breath because invariably what you're supposed to do would be either undoable, like go to the Andes and watch the setting sun, or a belief that's very unhelpful. So the number one belief that I really struggle with is that you've got to be positive all the time to beat cancer. Well, and the word to beat, which I'll come back to, but if you find somebody who's positive all the time, I'd love to meet them because that's a very unusual person and a very unusual life. Most of us, it's not possible in everyday life to be positive all the time, and certainly not with cancer. So that's a very unhelpful myth, because then what happens is, obviously the person with cancer, generally, there'll probably be a listener now who rings in and says, oh, I'm positive all the time. Wonderful. But most people aren't. And then what happens is they think, oh, I'm stressed today. That's very bad. My cancer is going to get worse, or it'll come back. And if it comes back, they blame themselves because they weren't. This is a terrible myth. It's very unhelpful. And the second part of this myth is this whole analogy of beating and fighting and battles. That's also very unhelpful. Most people with cancer are trudging into the hospital, barely able to get out of bed, sitting there having their chemotherapy and going home again. They're just trying to make their way through. They're trying to do their best to have their treatment and survive. It's not a battle. It's surviving, getting through.
Yeah, there was another psychiatrist I met through the Irish Cancer Society a couple of years back, and his words really struck me, that so many people sat in front of him and said, did I get cancer because I can't process my emotions properly? And I think it's excellent that we're starting to talk about the mind-body connection and all of that, but there's a danger in that. There should be no blame around a diagnosis.
Absolutely never blame. People with cancer have enough to be getting on with without blaming themselves. And I think part of the difficulty is in our current culture, we always want reasons. We want to explain things. And I think partly that's so that we can understand it and ideally make sure it doesn't happen again. But unfortunately, sadly, lots of bad things happen for which we cannot fully explain the reasons. Bad things happen to good people. I mean, I've had people sit in front of me saying, why have I got cancer? People are angry. I ate well, I swam in the sea, I exercised, I was a good person. Why me? Why have I got cancer? And unfortunately, often there isn't a good explanation. There are some for which there are, but in general, from a psychological perspective, there isn't. And these myths are very unhelpful for people who are trying to do their best to get through.
Yeah, and look, we're not going to fix it today, but I have a lot of issue with the health message because it kind of sells us if you live a certain way, certain things will happen, but we're not going to fix that today. You tackle some areas not often spoken about in the chapter Cancer and Sleep, Intimacy, Body Image, Infertility and Other Issues. I mean, these are huge life cornerstones that are often shrouded in secrecy.
Well, these are shrouded in secrecy. And I suppose a few things to say in response to that. First of all, some people are very private. They've always been very private. Now they've got cancer. They're still private people. They do not want to discuss their life history. not even necessarily in my office. And you have to respect that. And it's one of the things that people with cancer say. Suddenly, they feel very public. They've lost their hair. Strangers come up and say to them, oh, are you on chemotherapy? You know, my cousin was. They mean well, but the person with cancer can feel very intruded on. The area of intimacy is a very difficult area for many people to discuss. That's why it's called an area of intimacy, because it's a very private thing. But I wanted to give people the opportunity to discuss it, particularly family and friends. I used a story there, and all of the stories are anonymized and often they're melded together. But the story, the particular story about intimacy there, really underlined the communication problem. There was one person, the person with cancer, who'd had a desperate, terrible time, had surgery, felt disfigured, felt marked out, felt different, felt unlovable, unlikable, unattractive, and was really just gutted by everything. There was their partner who felt they were brilliant and thought that their scars were a sign of what a strong person they'd been, and were just so dying to show them that, but were afraid to approach them because they felt that they might upset them or they weren't ready. And so gradually the two of them went apart because one person felt rejected and the other person felt unloved. And really it was about communication. So that's why that story, a bit like you said earlier, we can't solve all of those massive topics in a brief discussion. But often communication is key. If people could only really talk to each other and hear what was happening.
And as you say, the power of shared experience is so important, but it's easier to read about a shared experience in a chapter than it is to discuss it in an open coffee shop. And that's completely fair enough when they come to those sort of topics. And one more taboo then, you touched on it earlier, and I actually am happy to discuss it. So I say happy, but I'm going to discuss it, cancer and death, because we can be guilty of brushing over this possibility with toxic positivity. And I think it's really important that we look at how far cancer rates, survival rates have come, that people are living with stage four cancer, you know, and living well. But is it important that we discuss this more? Because death as a taboo is actually inevitable to all of us.
I think it's very important. There's a chapter on dying. I wrote at the start of the chapter, and it was true. It was the chapter I found most difficult to write. I did not want to write it because most healthcare professionals, I would say all, but we'll say most, do not want to consider that possibility. We're all there for our patients to do well. We want them to do well, live well, be well. And yet they don't all do well. Now, again, for your listeners, most people do very well, but there will always be some people who will die, and we're all going to die. Back to what I said to you earlier, I don't like saying it, you probably don't like hearing it, but people with cancer have to face that. And yes, there are people, sadly, who will die due to their cancer. And I saw it. It was very difficult to witness, even as a healthcare professional, whatever about for their families, who often found it so devastating. Quite often, the person who was dying, they might not say, I'm dying. I gave an example, which was quite common, where somebody said, I'm tired. I'm tired. And they often are tired. They may have had multiple rounds of treatment. They just want to lay down their burden. They can't do it anymore. So they might say, I'm tired. I want to go home. I want to rest. What they're really saying is, I'm done. I can't do anymore. And then it's really difficult for the families and friends because they've been fighting and keeping going there. I'm using the word fighting, but on the person's behalf, looking for every cure, every treatment, phoning the world. And suddenly they have to sit and say they can't do that anymore. They've got to be with the person who is too tired to go on. Very difficult for families and friends. And, you know, I think it's the most difficult thing to do, and it's the most loving thing to do, to be able to be with that person in those final stages and to tolerate what must be huge fear and distress for that person who is dying. So I think we must talk about it, because if we can't talk about it because it's allegedly too distressing or unbearable, what is it like for the person that's going through it? It's just, we have to talk about it.
Well, we often say that there are not many people, if any people, who haven't been touched in some way by cancer in this country and beyond. And this book, The Cancer Guide, written by psychiatrist Professor Anne-Marie O'Dwyer, is a fantastic resource for anybody who has been touched by cancer in any way. Anne-Marie, thank you so much for writing it and for coming in to discuss it with me this morning.
Thank you very much.
Alive and Kicking. on News Talk.
Now, AINTAS are the National Adult Learning Association of Ireland. They advocate for and lobby for the quality education for all adults and raise awareness of the impact of adult learning on people's lives and on society. And to give us an example of that in action, I'm joined in studio now by Dervil Lawless, CEO of AINTAS, Kathleen Ryan, Advanced Manufacturing Programme Leader and Tutor, and Megan Lamb, adult learner and graduate of the Advanced Manufacturing Programme. Well, you're all very welcome.
Thank you so much for having us.
Dervil, can I start with you? For anyone who's not familiar with AINTAS, can you tell us about the work that you do?
Of course, yeah. AINTAS is a national adult learning organisation in Ireland. We promote adult and community education across the country and support everyone involved in it. So that's, you know, everybody from learners, tutors, trainers, staff, people working in education training boards or small community education organisations.
And with all kinds of education, I mean, it starts in school, we often just celebrate the qualification, the certificates, but there's a lot more to it than that, isn't there?
Of course, yeah. And I think that's the thing. So many people, when they think about education, it is just that qualification or going to work. But for us, it's really about social change and it's about building people's self-esteem and confidence. So like so many people that we meet from all walks of life, they might think first initially about, you know, I want to change jobs or I want to be accredited in this thing. But when they go in, they find out what they're really good at. They realize that they're super smart. They figure out their own strengths. They build their self-confidence. They meet new people. They make friends. They're connected to new communities. And you meet people from all walks of life, which is just wonderful because that doesn't often happen. And I think some of the really nice things is, even in terms of research, we know that people improve their health, physical and mental health, their overall well-being, all of those gorgeous things. And then also in terms of like being more active in your community. So like people who engage in adult education are far more likely to, you know, support their neighbours, get involved in activities, bring people together and say if there's a local issue, they're more likely to get involved in that local issue and try to resolve things. So they become really proactive citizens as well. It's wonderful.
I love that. And I bet you it's been a whisper, something that's been coming to them for a while. If only I could go back and do, or if only I could change that. And when you're actually showing up for yourself and making time to make those whispers a reality, it really does impact on your self-worth.
Huge. Like everybody that we meet says more often than not that their life's been changed. And like I've met people say, men in their 60s and 70s, and they might have taken years to work up the courage. One guy told me that it took him 3 years in a row to work up the courage to walk up the steps into his local centre because he was so nervous and he really wanted to go in there. And now he's learned to read and write and he's doing really well. There's other people maybe who are lone parents. And all of a sudden, instead of feeling like, you know, in this difficult situation, they have this new group of friends, they've done courses, they're now working in their local community, they have a higher income, they feel connected to other people around them. There's all of these amazing things are happening and it's like, it's such a broad range of stuff as well because adult education is like everything from, you know, knitting, sewing, learning to use computers, literacy, learning a new language, apprenticeships, programs, it's everything. Do you know what I mean? Any adult who engages in education, whatever shape or size, is involved in adult learning. And we're just so lucky that it brings people from all walks of life into that space.
And I love that you mentioned somebody in their 60s because sometimes life gets in the way. You're not just ignoring the whispers. Sometimes you don't have any choice, but it's never too late. And I think that's a really important message. The AINTAS Star Awards took place in Croke Park a few weeks ago. Tell us about the awards then and who they recognise.
Yeah, they're gorgeous. So like the Star Awards is something that's been running for a number of years. And really it's like showcasing the best in adult learning across the country, across the whole island of Ireland. We actually had PJ Gallagher as our celebrity guest and he was brilliant, very funny. On the day in Croke Park, we had over 25 groups coming from across the island. They were all so excited to be there. And it's like this big fancy event. We had a ukulele band. It's on the big stage. Everybody's real dressed up. Everybody was actually up dancing before we even began, which was great crack. And, you know, someone described it before in a play as the Oscars for community development. And it really does feel like that when you're there. It's just this massive celebration. And the programmes are everything, you know, under the themes of like health and well-being, access to third level global citizenship, learner voice, social inclusion. There's so many different types of amazing programs that are coming together to show the work that they've done, the amazing people who work there, the wonderful learners who are there. And then when they get on the stage, it's just this big excitement of like, we won. It's gorgeous. It really is.
Amazing. Well, if it's the Oscars of adult education, move over Cillian Murphy, because we have a winner in our midst. I want to bring you in, Kathleen. You're the programme leader of the Advanced Manufacturing Technician Traineeship at Kildare Wicklow Education Training Board. And the course won a Star Award a couple of weeks back. Tell us about that course.
Oh, we were thrilled to win. Yes, our course is a 1-year full-time course, and it's designed to offer a second chance education to adults who are marginalised from the workforce for any reason. So we attract a very diverse range of individuals, and we have people who may be long-term unemployed, people who simply want to upskill, get a better paid job. We have stay-at-home parents, we have refugees, people on international protection. We have every age range. Within one class, we could have somebody, we have maybe age 19 up to people in their 60s. So we attract a very diverse range of people. We operate outside of the CAO, and our focus is on eliminating many of the barriers that normally stop people from accessing a third level education. So we create a very supportive environment. It's a very kind, caring environment with all different levels of support that anybody might need to get through the course. We have state-of-the-art training centre, state-of-the-art technology and top-notch tutors. So we really set people up for success in the centre. And then at the end of the 1-year course, our graduates are fully qualified technicians, and they typically obtain jobs in the tech or pharma sector with big multinationals. We have people in Intel, Amazon, Pfizer, Microsoft, all of the top companies. Our graduates are working in them. So it's fantastic. People go from maybe very low paid jobs to maybe 60 or 70,000 per year after doing a 1-year course. So we're thrilled with that. It's like winning the lotto for us every day, seeing people enjoy that kind of success in their life.
Incredible. And do you think there are currently enough pathways, particularly to the areas like technology that you mentioned, for those marginalised in society?
No, there really aren't enough pathways, because so many groups are underrepresented in advanced manufacturing. And to be fair, a lot of the bigger companies are trying to attract people from more diverse backgrounds. So our course is perfect from that point of view, because FET courses in general tend to attract a diverse range. And then we're creating a direct pathway into technology. So even women are severely underrepresented in advanced manufacturing, and then all of the other groups that I mentioned as well. So the more paths we have, the better. But our course is particularly good because, like I say, it's really transformative within 1 year. And our next course actually starts on the 17th of June. If anybody would like to enrol, it's up on fetchcourses.ie or on kwetbtrainingservices.ie/manufacturing. Just to mention that if anybody would like to enrol next time around.
Fantastic. And we have one of your superstars here with us. Megan, you're a graduate of the Advanced Manufacturing Traineeship. Tell us about your education and work life before you took up the course.
Okay, so my education before, so I have dyslexia, so in school and stuff it was quite hard. I feel like I was kind of discouraged a lot from going into college and going further. I was exempt from Irish. I was below in maths, and that was my biggest issue, was maths. So I ended up doing a PLC course when I finished school. And from there onwards, I was working as a sales assistant. I was working as a car park attendant. I ended up working as a carer, which I loved, but none of them were really giving me the funds to live. So I was always kind of looking for, how could I go further? But I was always scared of going further in college. And for me personally, growing up and stuff, I loved problem solving. I loved fixing any kind of technical things in the family that would go wrong, like the telly or just the internet. Anything that went wrong, I'd always fix. But I never really thought anything of it. Do you want me to move forward then?
No, I'm hanging on your every word, Megan. And I think it's so important that we have this conversation, because this is why our school system doesn't currently serve neurodiverse, because it's not that you weren't capable, it's just that you didn't fit into that particular mold. But that has a big impact on your self-belief and your belief in your own abilities.
Absolutely. It completely crushed my kind of confidence in myself. So I kind of always just thought, I'm probably not clever enough to go further in college. So yeah, that stopped me.
So how did you hear about this particular course?
Well, so I was working in a school, and one of the teachers told me that she worked for Intel, and she worked for Pfizer and stuff. So she was telling me how amazing they were. And that's kind of when I was introduced to like women in STEM and stuff. So I started really looking into manufacturing, engineering. And so I was looking up courses and I found KWETB, which everything kind of ticked for me. It was close enough. It was just everything I wanted. So I was really nervous because I thought, can I do this? You know, me confidence again, kind of self-do. But I applied and I really just gave everything to it. Like for the interview and stuff, I really tried my best to get on the course because I was fully ready to flip my life around and change everything from minimum wage to completely just being able to support myself and my life, and not having to really rely on just having that independency, I suppose. So yeah, I mean, it was kind of stressful at the start because like applying, because I recently moved into a house at the time with my partner, and I was also trying to get me full license driving. So I was practicing me full license and stuff, me driving. And so I was really, I was kind of panicking about money as well, you know, even though I was on minimum wage, I wasn't on great money, but it was still some. Whereas going to the course now, they do have a way that I don't really know the way it works, but you get money for doing the course. So it wasn't like I was getting no money, but I was getting a loss.
Yeah, because you were obviously spending more time going to the course and, you know, bedding down with somebody in a new living experience takes effort, learning how to drive. So you had a lot going on, yeah. But you really thrived in this situation.
Absolutely, yeah. So like I really didn't, I thought I was good at problem solving and stuff, but I never really thought about it in that sense. Until I'd done the course, that's when I really truly realised my potential. And I was like, wow, I really actually do love putting pieces of a puzzle together and figuring out the problem. Yeah, and I mean, I struggled here and there where I would self-doubt or overthink. But the course, the tutors, Kathleen, was just absolutely amazing at like reminding us to take one step at a time, one day at a time, you know, not to jump too far ahead. That's a problem that I have, I think, is just kind of trying to jump too far ahead. But I feel like, not to dive somewhere else now, but I kind of, like as a woman and doing this stuff, like manufacturing, I kind of have, well, I feel like I have to over compromise a little bit. So I'm trying to do my best, but too much all at once. So Kathleen was amazing at kind of slowing my brain down and being like, right, just calm down. We have this. You're going to be fine.
Yeah, you don't have to represent all women
exactly,
in STEM.
You know, like,
but I can get that. And the more we kind of break down this gender divide, the less that'll be an issue for women going into the industry. So you completed the course, you qualified, and you went quickly into employment. So tell us what that has meant to your life.
Oh, just, I mean, I can't even explain. Like, it's changed my life in so many ways. I went from the course into Microsoft as a data center technician, and that was amazing. And now I'm working in a different company as a mechanical exhaust technician, which I absolutely love. I love the teamwork. I love just everything about it. The kind of the confidence that I have in myself of just knowing that I am clever enough now, and I can trust myself. You know.
Yeah. No, that's huge. I mean, that's absolutely priceless. Are you still available for friends and family to fix the TV and fix the internet if it goes down?
Somewhat. I do actually still get the call. Can you fix this?
Well, I'm going to be asking for your phone number at the end of all this. Well, this conversation has been absolutely magic. And I think people see signs for adult education, you know, maybe on a community notice board, and they don't realise the absolute magic that is behind that. So thank you so much to all of you for coming in to share that with us today. Chief Executive of Aintus, Derval Lawless. Kathleen Ryan, Programme Leader of the Advanced Manufacturing Technician Traineeship at Kildare Wicklow Education Training Board. And working superstar Megan Lamb, thank you so much to all of you for coming on. If you want to find out more, you can go to the website aintus.com or you'll find them on Instagram at Aintus Ireland. So that's it for Live and Kicking for this week. My thanks to my producer, Aidan McKelvey, and Hugo De Silva Scott, who was on sound. Thanks to all my guests, and thanks as ever to you for listening. I will see you next week.
Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna Sunday morning at 8 on News Talk.